Bell climbed the rear steps of the courthouse and went down the hall to his office. He swiveled his chair around and sat and looked at the telephone.
"Go ahead," he said. "I'm here."
The phone rang. He reached and picked it up.
"Sheriff Bell," he said.
He listened. He nodded.
"Mrs. Downey, I believe he'll come down directly. Why don't you call me back here in a little bit?" "Yes, ma'am."
He took off his hat and put it on the desk and sat with his eyes closed, pinching the bridge of his nose.
"Yes, ma'am," he said. "Yes, ma'am. Mrs. Downey, I haven't seen that many dead cats in trees. I think he'll come down directly if you'll just leave him be. You call me back in a little bit, you hear?"
He hung the phone up and sat looking at it.
"It's money," he said. "You have enough money, you don't have to talk to people about cats and trees. Well, maybe you do."
The radio squawked. He picked up the receiver and pushed the button and put his feet up on the desk.
"Bell," he said.
He sat listening. He lowered his feet to the floor and sat up.
"Get the keys and look in the turtle." "Now that's all right. I'm right here."
He drummed his fingers on the desk.
"All right. Keep your lights on. I'll be there in 50 minutes. And Torbert, shut the trunk."
He and Wendell pulled into the paved shoulder in front of the unit and parked and got out. Torbert got out and was standing by the door of his car. The sheriff nodded. He walked along the edge of the roadway, studying the tire tracks.
"You seen this, I reckon," he said.
"Yes, sir."
"Well, let's take a look."
Torbert opened the trunk, and they stood looking at the body. The front of the man's shirt was covered with blood, partly dried. His whole face was bloody. Bell leaned and reached into the trunk and took something from the man's shirt pocket and unfolded it. It was a blood-stained receipt for gas from a service station in Junction, Texas.
"Well," he said, "this was the end of the road for Bill Wyrick."
"I didn't look to see if he had a billfold on him."
"That's all right. He don't. This here was just dumb luck."
He studied the hole in the man's forehead.
"Looks like a .45. Clean. Almost like a wad cutter."
"What's a wad cutter?"
"It's a target round. You got the keys?"
"Yes, sir."
Bell shut the trunk lid. He looked around. Passing trucks on the interstate were downshifting as they approached.
"I've already talked to Lamar. Told him he can have his unit back in about 3 days. I called Austin, and they're looking for you first thing in the morning. Now, I ain't loading them into one of our units, and he damn sure don't need a helicopter. You take Lamar's unit back to Sonora when you get done and call, and me or Wendell One will come and get you. You got any money?"
"Yes, sir."
"Fill out the report, same as any report."
"Yes, sir."
"White male, late 30s, medium build."
"How do you spell Wyrick?"
"You don't spell it. We don't know what his name is."
"Yes, sir."
"He might have a family someplace."
"Yes, sir." "Sheriff?"
"Yes."
"What do we have on the perpetrator?"
"We don't. Give Wendell your keys before you forget it."
"They're in the unit."
"Well, let's not be leaving keys in the units."
"Yes, sir."
"I'll see you in 2 days' time."
"Yes, sir."
"I hope that son of a bitch is in California."
"Yes, sir, I know what you mean."
"I got a feeling he ain't."
"Yes, sir, I do too."
"Wendell, you ready?"
Wendell leaned and spat.
"Yes, sir," he said, "I'm ready."
He looked at Torbert.
"You get stopped with that old boy in the turtle, just tell him you don't know nothing about it. Tell him somebody must have put him in there while you was having coffee."
Torbert nodded.
"You and the sheriff going to come down and get me off of death row?"
"If we can't get you out, we'll get in there with you."
"You all don't be making light of the dead that-a-way," Bell said.
Wendell nodded.
"Yes, sir," he said. "You're right. I might be one myself someday."
Driving out 90 toward the turnoff at Dryden, he came across a hawk dead in the road. He saw the feathers move in the wind. He pulled over and got out and walked back and squatted on his boot heels and looked at it. He raised one wing and let it fall again. Cold yellow eye, dead to the blue vault above them. It was a big red tail. He picked it up by one wingtip and carried it to the bar ditch and laid it in the grass. They would hunt the blacktop, sitting on the high power poles and watching the highway in both directions for miles, any small thing that might venture to cross. Closing on their prey against the sun, shadowless, lost in the concentration of the hunter. He wouldn't have the trucks running over it. He stood there, looking out across the desert, so quiet. Low hum of wind in the wires. High bloodweeds along the road. Wiregrass and sacawista. Beyond in the stone arroyos, the tracks of dragons. The raw rock mountains shadowed in the late sun, and to the east, the shimmering abscissa of the desert plains under a sky where rain curtains hung dark as soot all along the quadrant. That god lives in silence who has scoured the following land with salt and ash. He walked back to the cruiser and got in and pulled away. When he pulled up in front of the sheriff's office in Sonora, the first thing he saw was the yellow tape stretched across the parking lot, a small courthouse crowd. He got out and crossed the street.
"What's happened, Sheriff?"
"I don't know," said Bell. "I just got here."
He ducked under the tape and went up the steps. Lamar looked up when he tapped at the door.
"Come in, Ed Tom," he said. "Come in. We got hell to pay here."
They walked out on the courthouse lawn. Some of the men followed them.
"You all go on," said Lamar. "Me and the sheriff here need to talk."
He looked haggard. He looked at Bell, and he looked at the ground. He shook his head and looked away.
"I used to play mumbly peg here when I was a boy, right here. These youngsters today I don't think would even know what that was. Ed Tom, this is a damned lunatic." "I hear you."
"You got anything to go on?"
"Not really."
Lamar looked away. He wiped his eyes with the back of his sleeve.
"I'll tell you right now. This son of a bitch will never see a day in court. Not if I catch him, he won't." "Well, we need to catch him first. That boy was married." "I didn't know that."
23-year-old. Clean-cut boy, straight as a die.
"Now I gotta go out to his house, for his wife hears it on a damn radio." "I don't envy you that, I surely don't." "I think I'm going to quit, Ed Tom." "You want me to go out there with you?"
"No, I appreciate it. I need to go."
"All right."
"I just have this feeling we're looking at something we really ain't never even seen before."
"I got the same feeling." "Let me call you this evening."
"I appreciate it."
He watched Lamar cross the lawn and climb the steps to his office.
"I hope you don't quit," he said. "I think we're going to need all of you we can get."
When they pulled up in front of the cafe, it was 1:20 in the morning. There were only three people on the bus.
"Sanderson," the driver said.
Moss made his way forward. He'd seen the driver eyeing him in the mirror.
"Listen," he said, "you think you could let me out down at the desert air? I got a bad leg, and I live down there, but I got nobody to pick me up."
The driver shut the door.
"Yeah," he said, "I can do that."
When he walked in, she got up off the couch and ran and put her arms around his neck.
"I thought you was dead," she said.
"Well, I ain't, so don't go slobbering."
"I ain't."
"Why don't you fix me some bacon and eggs while I take a shower?"
"Let me see that cut on your head. What happened to you? Where's your truck at?"
"I need to take a shower. Fix me something to eat. My stomach thinks my throat's been cut."
When he came out of the shower, he was wearing a pair of shorts, and when he sat at the little formica table in the kitchen, the first thing she said was,
"What's that on the back of your arm?"
"How many eggs is this?"
"4."
"You got any more toast?"
"There's 2 more pieces coming. What is that, Llewellyn?"
What would you like to hear?
The truth.
He sipped his coffee and set about salting his eggs.
You ain't gonna tell me, are you?
No.
What happened to your leg?
It's broke out in a rash. She buttered the fresh toast and put it on the plate and sat in the chair opposite. I'd like to eat breakfast of a night, he said. Takes me back to my bachelor days.
What is going on, Llewellyn?
Here's what's going on, Carla Jean. You need to get your stuff packed and be ready to roll out of here come daylight. Whatever you leave, you ain't going to see it again, so if you want it, don't leave it. There's a bus leaves out of here at 7:15 in the morning. I want you to go to Odessa and wait there till I can call you. She sat back in the chair and watched him.
You want me to go to Odessa, she said.
That's correct.
You ain't kidding, are you?
Me? No. I ain't kidding a bit. Are we out of preserves? She got up and got the preserves out of the refrigerator and set them on the table and sat back down. He unscrewed the jar and ladled some onto his toast and spread it with his knife.
What's in that satchel you brought in?
I told you what was in that satchel.
You said it was full of money.
Well, then, I reckon that's what's in it.
Where's it at?
Under the bed in the back room.
Under the bed?
Yes, ma'am.
Can I go back there and look?
You're free, white, and 21, so I reckon you can do whatever you want.
I ain't 21.
Well, whatever you are.
And you want me to get on a bus and go to Odessa?
You are getting on a bus and going to Odessa.
What am I supposed to tell Mama?
Well, try standing in the door and hollering, Mama, I'm home.
Where's your truck at?
Gone the way of all flesh. Nothing's forever.
How are we supposed to get down there in the morning?
Call Miss Rosa over yonder. She ain't got nothing to do.
What have you done, Llewellyn?
I robbed the bank at Fort Stockton.
You're a lying sack of you-know-what.
If you ain't gonna believe me, what'd you ask me for? You need to get on back there and get your stuff together. We got about 4 hours till daylight.
Let me see that thing on your arm.
You done seen it.
Let me put something on it.
Yeah, I think there's some buckshot salve in the cabinet if we ain't out. Will you go on and quit aggravating me? I'm trying to eat.
Did you get shot?
No. I just said that to get you stirred up. Now go on now.
He crossed the Pecos River, just north of Sheffield, Texas, and took Route 349 south. When he pulled into the filling station at Sheffield, it was almost dark. A long red twilight, with doves crossing the highway, heading south toward some ranch tanks. He got change from the proprietor and made a phone call and filled the tank and went back in and paid.
"You all getting any rain up your way?" the proprietor said.
"Which way would that be?"
"I seen yous from Dallas."
Shiger picked his change up off the counter.
"And what business is it of yours where I'm from, friendo?"
"I didn't mean nothing by it."
"You didn't mean nothing by it?"
"I was just passing the time of day."
"I guess that passes for manners in your cracker view of things."
"Well, sir, I apologized. If you don't want to accept my apology, I don't know what else I can do for you."
"How much are these?"
"Sir?"
"I said, how much are these?"
69 cents.
Shiger unfolded a dollar onto the counter. The man rang it up and stacked the change before him the way a dealer places chips. Shiger hadn't taken his eyes from him. The man looked away. He coughed. Shiger opened the plastic package of cashews with his teeth and doled a third part of them into his palm and stood eating.
"Will there be something else?"
the man said.
"I don't know, will there?"
"Is there something wrong?"
"With what?"
"With anything."
"Is that what you're asking me? Is there something wrong with anything?"
The man turned away and put his fist to his mouth and coughed again. He looked at Shiger and he looked away. He looked out the window at the front of the store, the gas pumps and the car sitting there. Shiger ate another small handful of the cashews. Will there be anything else? You've already asked me that. Well, I need to see about closing.
See about closing?
Yes, sir.
What time do you close?
Now. We close now.
Now is not a time. What time do you close?
Generally, around dark, at dark.
Sugar stood slowly chewing.
You don't know what you're talking about, do you?
Sir?
I said, you don't know what you're talking about, do you?
Well, I'm talking about closing. That's what I'm talking about.
What time do you go to bed?
Sir?
You're a bit deaf, aren't you? I said, what time do you go to bed?
Well, I'd say around 9:30. Somewhere around 9:30.
Sugar poured more cashews into his palm.
I could come back then, he said.
We'll be closed then.
That's all right.
Well, why would you be coming back? We'll be closed.
You said that.
Well, we will.
You live in that house behind the store?
Yes, I do.
You've lived here all your life.
The proprietor took a while to answer.
This was my wife's father's place, he said, originally.
You married into it.
We lived in Temple, Texas for many years. Raised a family there, in Temple. We come out here about 4 years ago.
You married into it.
If that's the way you want to put it.
I don't have some way to put it. That's the way it is.
Well, I need to close now.
Sugar poured the last of the cashews into his palm and wadded the little bag and placed it on the counter. He stood oddly erect, chewing.
You seem to have a lot of questions, the proprietor said, for somebody that don't want to say where it is they're from.
What's the most you ever saw lost on a coin toss?
Sir?
I said, what's the most you ever saw lost on a coin toss?
Coin toss?
Coin toss.
I don't know. Folks don't generally bet on a coin toss. It's usually more like just to settle something.
What's the biggest thing you ever saw settled?
I don't know.
Sugar took a 25-cent piece from his pocket and flipped it spinning into the bluish glare of the fluorescent lights overhead. He caught it and slapped it onto the back of his forearm, just above the bloody wrappings.
Call it, he said.
Call it?
Yes.
For what?
Just call it.
Well, I need to know what it is we're calling here.
How would that change anything?
The man looked at Sugar's eyes for the first time. Blue as lapis, at once glistening and totally opaque, like wet stones.
You need to call it, Sugar said. I can't call it for you. It wouldn't be fair. It wouldn't even be right. Just call it.
I didn't put nothing up.
Yes, you did. You've been putting it up your whole life. You just didn't know it. You know what the date is on this coin?
No.
It's 1958. It's been traveling 22 years to get here, and now it's here. And I'm here. And I've got my hand over it, and it's either heads or tails, and you have to say, call it.
I don't know what it is I stand to win.
In the blue light, the man's face was beaded thinly with sweat. He licked his upper lip.
You stand to win everything, Sugar said. Everything.
You ain't making any sense, mister.
Call it.
Heads, then.
Sugar uncovered the coin. He turned his arm slightly for the man to see.
Well done, he said.
He picked the coin from his wrist and handed it across.
What do I want with that?
Take it. It's your lucky coin.
Well, I don't need it.
Yes, you do. Take it.
The man took the coin.
I got to close now, he said.
Don't put it in your pocket.
sir?
Don't put it in your pocket.
Where do you want me to put it?
Don't put it in your pocket. You won't know which one it is.
All right.
Anything can be an instrument, Sugar said. Small things, things you wouldn't even notice. They pass from hand to hand. People don't pay any attention. And then one day, there's an accounting. And after that, nothing is the same. Well, you say, it's just a coin, for instance. Nothing special there. What could that be an instrument of? You see the problem. To separate the act from the thing, as if the parts of some moment in history might be interchangeable with the parts of some other moment. How could that be? Well, it's just a coin. Yes, that's true. Is it?
Sugar cupped his hand and scooped his change from the counter into his palm and put the change in his pocket and turned and walked out the door. The proprietor watched him go, watched him get into the car. The car started and pulled off from the gravel apron onto the highway south. The lights never did come on. He laid the coin on the counter and looked at it. He put both hands on the counter and just stood leaning there with his head bowed. When he got to Dryden, it was about 8 o'clock. He sat at the intersection in front of Condra's feed store with the lights off and the motor running. Then he turned the lights on and pulled out on Highway 90, headed east. The white marks at the side of the road, when he found them, looked like surveyor's marks, but there were no numbers, just the chevrons. He marked the mileage on the odometer and drove another mile and slowed and turned off the highway. He shut off the lights and left the motor running and got out and walked down and opened the gate and came back. He drove across the bars at the cattle guard and got out and closed the gate again and stood there listening. Then he got in the car and drove out down the rutted track. He followed a south-running fence, the ford wallowing over the bad ground. The fence was just an old remnant, 3 wires strung on mesquite posts. In a mile or so, he came out on a gravel plain where a Dodge Ram Charger was parked facing toward him. He pulled slowly alongside it and shut down the engine. The Ram Charger's windows were tinted so dark they looked black. Sugar opened the door and got out. A man got out on the passenger side of the Dodge and folded the seat forward and climbed into the rear. Sugar walked around the vehicle and got in and shut the door.
"Let's go," he said.
"Have you talked to him?" the driver said.
"No."
"He don't know what's happened?"
"No. Let's go."
They rolled out across the desert in the dark.
"When do you aim to tell him?" the driver said.
"When I know what it is that I'm telling him."
When they came to Moss's truck, Sugar leaned forward to study it.
"Is that his truck?"
"That's it. Plates is gone."
"Pull up here. Have you got a screwdriver?"
"Look in the jockey box there."
Sugar got out with a screwdriver and walked over to the truck and opened the door. He pried the aluminum inspection plate off of the rivets inside the door and put it in his pocket and came back and got in and put the screwdriver back in the glove box.
"Who cut the tires?" he said.
"It wasn't us."
Sugar nodded.
"Let's go," he said.
They parked some distance from the trucks and walked down to look at them. Sugar stood there a long time. It was cold out on the Barrial, and he had no jacket, but he didn't seem to notice. The other two men stood waiting. He had a flashlight in his hand, and he turned it on and walked among the trucks and looked at the bodies. The two men followed at a small distance.
"Whose dog?" Sugar said.
"We don't know."
He stood looking in at the dead man slumped across the console of the Bronco. He shone the light into the cargo space behind the seats.
"Where's the box?" he said.
"It's in the truck. You want it?"
"Can you get anything on it?"
"No."
"Nothing?"
"Not a bleep."
Sugar studied the dead man. He jostled him with his flashlight. "These are some ripe petunias," one of the men said.
Sugar didn't answer. He backed out of the truck and stood looking over the bajada in the moonlight. Dead quiet. The man in the Bronco hadn't been dead 3 days or anything like it. He pulled a pistol from the waistband of his trousers and turned around to where the two men were standing and shot them once each through the head in rapid succession and put the gun back in his belt. The second man had actually half-turned to look at the first as he fell.
Sugar stepped between them and bent and pulled away the shoulder strap from the second man and swung up the 9mm Glock he'd been carrying and walked back out to the vehicle and got in and started it and backed around and drove up out of the caldera and back toward the highway.
Part 3.
I don't know that law enforcement benefits all that much from new technology. Tools that comes into our hands comes into theirs, too. Not that you can go back, or that you'd even want to. We used to have them old Motorola two-way radios. We've had the high band now for several years. Some things ain't changed. Common sense ain't changed. I'll tell my deputies sometimes to just follow the breadcrumbs. I still like the old Colts 44-40. If that won't stop 'em, you'd better throw the thing down and take off running. I like the old Winchester Model 97. I like it that it's got a hammer. I don't like having to hunt the safety on a gun. Of course, some things is worse. That cruiser of mine is 7 years old. It's got the 454 in it. You can't get that engine no more. I drove one of the new ones. It wouldn't outrun a fat man. I told the man I thought I'd stick with what I had. That ain't always a good policy, but it ain't always a bad one, neither. This other thing I don't know. People will ask me about it ever so often. I can't say as I would rule it out altogether. It ain't something I would like to have to see again, to witness. The ones that really ought to be on death row will never make it. I believe that. You remember certain things about a thing like that. People didn't know what to wear. There was one or two come dressed in black, which I suppose was all right. Some of the men come just in their shirt sleeves, and that kindly bothered me. I ain't sure I could tell you why. Still, they seemed to know what to do, and that surprised me. Most of them I know had never been to an execution before. When it was over, they pulled this curtain around the gas chamber with him in there, sitting slumped over, and people just got up and filed out. Like out of church or something. It just seemed peculiar. Well, it was peculiar. I'd have to say it was probably the most unusual day I ever spent. Quite a few people didn't believe in it. Even them that worked on the row, you'd be surprised. Some of them, I think, had at one time. You see somebody every day sometimes for years, and then one day you walk that man down the hallway and put him to death. Well, that'll take some of the cackle out of just about anybody. I don't care who it is. And, of course, some of them boys was not very bright. Chaplain Pickett told me about one he'd ministered to, and he ate his last meal, and he'd ordered this dessert, ever what it was. And it come time to go, and Pickett, he asked him didn't he want his dessert, and the old boy told him he was saving it for when he come back. I don't know what to say about that. Pickett didn't either. I never had to kill nobody, and I am very glad of that fact. Some of the old-time sheriffs wouldn't even carry a firearm. A lot of folks find that hard to believe, but it's a fact. Jim Scarborough never carried one. That's the younger Jim. Gaston Boykins wouldn't wear one, up in Comanche County. I always like to hear about the old-timers. Never missed a chance to do so. The old-time concern that the sheriffs had for their people has been watered down some. You can't help but feel it. Nigger Hoskins over in Bastrop County knowed everybody's phone number in the whole county by heart. It's a odd thing when you come to think about it. The opportunities for abuse are just about everywhere. There's no requirements in the Texas state constitution for being a sheriff. Not a one. There's no such thing as a county law. You think about a job where you have pretty much the same authority as God, and there's no requirements put upon you. And you are charged with preserving non-existent laws, and you tell me if that's peculiar or not. Because I say that it is. Does it work? Yes. 90% of the time. It takes very little to govern good people. Very little. And bad people can't be governed at all. Or if they could, I never heard of it.
The bus pulled into Fort Stockton at 8:45, and Moss stood and got his bag down from the overhead rack and picked up the document case out of the seat and stood looking down at her.
"Don't get on an airplane with that thing," she said. "They'll put you under the jail."
My mama didn't raise no ignorant children.
"When you going to call me?"
"I'll call you in a few days."
"All right."
"You take care."
"I got a bad feeling, Llewellyn."
"Well, I got a good one, so they ought to balance out."
"I hope so."
"I can't call you except from a payphone."
"I know it. Call me."
"I will. Quit worrying about everything."
"Llewellyn?"
"What?"
"Nothing."
"What is it?"
"Nothing. I just wanted to say it."
"You take care."
"Llewellyn."
"What?"
"Don't hurt nobody, you hear?"
He stood there with the bag slung across his shoulder. "I ain't making no promises," he said. "That's how you get hurt." Bell had raised the first forkful of his supper to his mouth when the phone rang. He lowered it again. She'd started to push her chair back, but he wiped his mouth with his napkin and rose.
"I'll get it," he said.
"All right."
"How the hell do they know when you're eating? We never eat this late."
"Don't be cussing," she said.
He picked up the phone.
"Sheriff Bell," he said.
He listened for a while. Then he said,
"I'm going to finish my supper. I'll meet you there in about 40 minutes. Just leave the lights on your unit."
He hung up the phone and came back to his chair and sat and picked up the napkin and put it in his lap and picked up his fork.
"Somebody called in a car afire," he said, "just this side of Lozier Canyon."
"What do you make of that?"
He shook his head. He ate. He drank the last of his coffee.
"Come go with me," he said.
"Let me get my coat."
They pulled off the road at the gate and drove over the cattle guard and pulled up behind Wendell's unit. Wendell walked back and Bell rolled down the window.
"It's about a half mile down," Wendell said. "Just follow me."
"I can see it."
"Yes, sir. It was going real good here about an hour ago. The people that called it in seen it from the road."
They parked a little way off and got out and stood looking at it.
"You could feel the heat on your face."
Bell came around and opened the door and took his wife's hand. She got out and stood with her arms folded in front of her. There was a pickup truck parked a ways down, and two men were standing there in the dull red glare. They nodded each in turn and said, "Sheriff?"
"We could have brought wieners," she said.
"Yeah, marshmallows."
"You wouldn't think a car would burn like that."
"No, you wouldn't. Did you all see anything?"
"No, sir. Just the fire."
"Didn't pass nobody or nothing?"
"No, sir."
"Does that look to you like about a 77 Ford, Wendell?"
"It could be."
"I'd say it is."
"Was that what that old boy was driving?"
"Yeah, Dallas plates."
"It wasn't his day, was it, Sheriff?"
"It surely wasn't."
"Why do you reckon they set fire to it?"
"I don't know."
Wendell turned and spat.
"Wasn't what the old boy had in mind when he left Dallas, I don't reckon, was it?"
Bell shook his head.
"No," he said. "I'd guess it was about the farthest thing from his mind."
In the morning, when he got to the office, the phone was ringing. Torbert wasn't back yet. He finally called at 9:30, and Bell sent Wendell to get him. Then he sat with his feet on the desk, staring at his boots. He sat that way for some time. Then he picked up the mobile and called Wendell.
"Where you at?"
"Just past Sanderson Canyon.
Turn around and come back."
"All right. What about Torbert?"
"Call him and tell him to just set tight. I'll come get him this afternoon."
"Yes, sir."
"Go to the house and get the keys to the truck from Loretta and hook up the horse trailer. Saddle my horse and Loretta's and load. And I'll see you out there in about an hour."
"Yes, sir."
He hung up the speaker and got up and went down to check on the jail. They drove through the gate and closed it again and drove down along the fence about 100 feet and parked. Wendell unlatched the trailer doors and led the horses out. Bell took the reins of his wife's horse.
"You ride Winston," he said.
"You sure?"
"Oh, I'm more than sure. Anything happens to Loretta's horse, I can tell you right now, you damn sure don't want to be the party that was aboard him."
He handed Wendell one of the lever-action rifles he'd brought and swung up into the saddle and pulled his hat down.
"You ready?" he said.
They rode side by side.
"We've drove all through their tracks, but you can still see what it was," Bell said. "Big off-road tires."
"When they got to the car, it was just a blackened hulk."
"You were right about the plates," Wendell said. "I lied about the tires, though."
"How's that?"
"I said they'd still be burning."
The car sat in what looked like 4 puddles of tar, the wheels wrapped in blackened skeins of wire. They rode on. Bell pointed at the ground from time to time.
"You can tell the day tracks from the night ones," he said. "They were driving out here with no lights. See there how crooked the track is? Like you can just see far enough ahead to duck the brush in front of you. Or you might leave some paint on a rock like that right yonder."
In a sand wash, he got down and walked up and back and then looked away toward the south.
"It's the same tire tread coming back as was going down. Made about the same time. You can see the sipes real clear. Which way they're going? They's 2 or more trips each way, I'd say."
Wendell sat his horse, his hands crossed on the big roping pommel. He leaned and spat. He looked off to the south with the sheriff.
"What do you reckon it is we're fixing to find down here?"
"I don't know," Bell said.
He put his foot in the stirrup and stood easily up into the saddle and put the little horse forward.
"I don't know," he said again, "but I can't say as I'm much looking forward to it."
When they reached Moss's truck, the sheriff sat and studied it and then rode slowly around it. Both doors were open.
"Somebody's pried the inspection plate off the door," he said.
"The numbers is on the frame."
"Yeah, I don't think that's why they took it."
"I know that truck."
"I do, too."
Wendell leaned and patted the horse on the neck.
"The boy's name is Moss."
"Yep."
Bell rode back around the rear of the truck and turned the horse to the south and looked at Wendell.
"You know where he lives at?"
"No, sir."
"He's married, ain't he?"
"I believe he is."
The sheriff sat looking at the truck.
"I was just thinking it'd be a curious thing if he was missing 2 or 3 days and nobody said nothing about it."
"Pretty curious."
Bell looked down toward the caldera.
"I think we got some real mischief here."
"I hear you, sheriff."
"You think this boy's a dope runner?"
"I don't know. I wouldn't have thought it."
"I wouldn't either. Let's go down here and look at the rest of this mess."
They rode down into the caldera, carrying the Winchesters upright before them in a saddle bow.
"I hope this boy ain't dead down here," Bell said. "He seemed a decent enough boy the time or two I seen him. Pretty wife, too."
They rode past the bodies on the ground and stopped and got down and dropped the reins. The horses stepped nervously.
"Let's take the horses out yonder a ways," Bell said. "They don't need to see this."
Yes, sir.
When he came back, Bell handed him 2 billfolds he'd taken from the bodies. He looked toward the trucks.
These 2 ain't been dead all that long, he said.
Where are they from?
Dallas.
He handed Wendell a pistol he'd picked up, and then he squatted and leaned on the rifle he was carrying.
These 2's been executed, he said. One of their own, I'd say. The old boy never even got the safety off that pistol. Both of them shot between the eyes.
The other one didn't have a gun?
Killer could have took it, or he might not have had one.
Bad way to go to a gunfight.
Bad way.
They walked among the trucks.
These some bitches are bloody as hogs,
Wendell said.
Yeah, Wendell said. I guess you ought to be careful about cussing the dead.
I'd say at the least there probably ain't no luck in it.
It's just a bunch of Mexican drug runners.
They were. They ain't now.
I ain't sure what you're saying.
I'm just saying that whatever they were, the only thing they are now is dead.
I'll have to sleep on that.
The sheriff tilted forward the Bronco seat and looked in the rear. He wet his finger and pressed it to the carpet and held his finger to the light.
That's been some of that old Mexican brown dope in the back of this rig.
Long gone now, though, ain't it?
Long gone.
Wendell squatted and studied the ground under the door.
It looks like there's some more here on the ground. Could be that somebody cut into one of the packages, see what was inside.
Could have been checking the quality, getting ready to trade.
They didn't trade, they shot each other.
Bell nodded.
There might not have even been no money.
That's possible.
But you don't believe it?
Bell thought about it.
No, he said. Probably I don't.
There was a second mix-up out here.
Yes, Bell said. At least that.
He rose and pushed the seat back.
This good citizen's been shot between the eyes, too.
Yup.
They walked around the truck. Bell pointed.
That's been a machine gun. Them straight runs yonder.
I'd say it has. So where do you reckon the driver got to?
It's probably one of them laying in the grass yonder.
Bell had taken out his kerchief, and he held it across his nose and reached in and picked up a number of brass shell casings out of the floor and looked at the numbers stamped in the base.
What calibers you got there, Sheriff?
9mm, a couple of 45 ACPs.
He dropped the shells back into the floor and stepped back and picked up his rifle from where he'd leaned it against the vehicle.
Somebody's unloaded on this thing with a shotgun by the look of it.
You think them holes are big enough?
I don't think they're double lot. More likely number 4 buck.
More buck for your bang.
You could put it that way. You want to clean out a alley? That's a pretty good way to go.
Wendell looked over the Caldera.
Well, he said, somebody's walked away from here.
I'd say they have.
How come do you reckon the coyotes ain't been at them?
Bell shook his head.
I don't know, he said. Supposedly they won't eat a Mexican.
Them over yonder ain't Mexican.
Well, that's true.
It must have sounded like Vietnam out here.
Vietnam, the sheriff said.
They walked out between the trucks. Bell picked up a few more casings and looked at them and dropped them again. He picked up a blue plastic speed loader. He stood and looked over the scene.
I'll tell you what, he said.
Tell me.
It don't much stand to reason that the last man never even got hit.
I would agree with that.
Why don't we get the horses and just ride up here a ways and look around? Maybe cut for sign a little.
We can do that.
Can you tell me what they wanted with a dog out here?
I got no idea.
When they found the dead man in the rocks a mile to the northeast, Bell just sat his wife's horse. He sat there for a long time.
What are you thinking, Sheriff?
The sheriff shook his head. He got down and walked over to where the dead man lay slumped. He walked over the ground, the rifle yoked across his shoulders. He squatted and studied the grass.
We got another execution here, Sheriff?
No. I believe this one's died of natural causes.
Natural causes?
Natural to the line of work he's in.
He ain't got a gun.
No.
Wendell leaned and spat.
Somebody's been here before us.
I'd say so.
You think he was packing the money?
I'd say there's a good chance of it.
So we still ain't found the last man, have we?
Bell didn't answer. He rose and stood looking out over the country.
It's a mess, ain't it, Sheriff?
If it ain't, it'll do till a mess gets here.
They rode back across the upper end of the caldera. They sat the horses and looked down at Moss's truck.
So, where do you think this good old boy is at?
Wendell said.
I do not know.
I take it his whereabouts is pretty high on your work list.
The sheriff nodded.
Pretty high, he said.
They drove back to town, and the sheriff sent Wendell on to the house with the truck and the horses.
You be sure and rap on the kitchen door and thank Loretta.
I will. I got to give her the keys anyways.
The county don't pay her to use her horse.
I hear you.
He called Torbert on the mobile phone.
I'm coming to get you, he said. Just set tight.
When he pulled up in front of Lamar's office, the police tape was still strung across the courthouse lawn. Torbert was sitting on the steps. He got up and walked out to the car.
You all right? Bell said.
Yes, sir.
Where's Sheriff Lamar?
He's out in the call.
They drove out toward the highway. Bell told the deputy about the caldera. Torbert listened in silence. He rode, looking out the window. After a while, he said,
I got the report from Austin.
What did they say?
Not much of anything.
What was he shot with?
They don't know.
They don't know?
No, sir.
How can they not know? There wasn't no exit wound.
Yes, sir. They freely admitted that.
Freely admitted?
Yes, sir.
Well, what the hell did they say, Torbert?
They said that he had what looked to be a large-caliber bullet wound in the forehead, and that said wound had penetrated to a distance of approximately 2.5 inches through the skull and into the frontal lobe of the brain, but that there was not no bullet to be found.
Said wound.
Yes, sir.
Bell pulled out onto the interstate. He drummed his fingers on the steering wheel. He looked at his deputy.
What you're saying don't make no sense, Torbert.
I told him that.
To which they responded?
They didn't respond nothing. They're sending the report, FedEx, X-rays and everything. They said you'd have it in your office by in the morning.
They rode along in silence. After a while, Torbert said,
This whole thing is just hell in spectacles, ain't it, Sheriff?
Yes, it is.
How many bodies is it altogether?
Good question. I ain't sure I even counted. 8, 9, with Deputy Haskins.
Torbert studied the country out there, the shadows long on the road.
Who the hell are these people? He said.
I don't know. I used to say they were the same ones we've always had to deal with, same ones my granddaddy had to deal with. Back then they was rustling cattle, now they're running dope. But I don't know if that's true no more. I'm like you. I ain't sure we've seen these people before, their kind. I don't know what to do about 'em even. If you killed 'em all, they'd have to build an annex onto hell.
Shiger pulled into the desert air shortly before noon and parked just below Moss's trailer and shut off the engine. He got out and walked across the raw dirt yard and climbed the steps and tapped at the aluminum door. He waited. Then he tapped again. He turned and stood with his back to the trailer and studied the little park. Nothing moved, not a dog. He turned and put his wrist to the door lock and shot out the lock cylinder with the cobalt steel plunger of the cattle gun and opened the door and went in and shut the door behind him. He stood, the deputy's revolver in his hand. He looked in the kitchen. He walked back into the bedroom. He walked through the bedroom and pushed open the bathroom door and went into the second bedroom. Clothes on the floor, the closet door open. He opened the top dresser drawer and closed it again. He put the gun back in his belt and pulled his shirt over it and walked back out to the kitchen. He opened the refrigerator and took a carton of milk and opened it and smelled it and drank. He stood there holding the carton in one hand and looking out the window. He drank again, and then he put the carton back in the refrigerator and shut the door. He went into the living room and sat on the sofa. There was a perfectly good 21-inch television on the table. He looked at himself in the dead gray screen. He rose and got the mail off the floor and sat back down and went through it. He folded three of the envelopes and put them in his shirt pocket and then rose and went out. He drove down and parked in front of the office and went in.
"Yes, sir," the woman said.
"I'm looking for Llewellyn Moss."
She studied him.
"Did you go up to his trailer?"
"Yes, I did."
"Well, I'd say he's at work. Did you want to leave a message?"
"Where does he work?"
"Sir, I ain't at liberty to give out no information about our residence."
Sugar looked around at the little plywood office. He looked at the woman.
"Where does he work?"
"Sir?"
I said, "Where does he work?"
"Did you not hear me? We can't give out no information."
A toilet flushed somewhere. A door latch clicked. Sugar looked at the woman again. Then he went out and got in the Ram Charger and left. He pulled in at the cafe and took the envelopes out of his shirt pocket and unfolded them and opened them and read the letters inside. He opened the phone bill and looked at the charges. There were calls to Del Rio and to Odessa. He went in and got some change and went to the payphone and dialed the Del Rio number, but there was no answer. He called the Odessa number and a woman answered and he asked for Llewellyn. The woman said he wasn't there.
I tried to reach him in Sanderson, but I don't believe he's there anymore.
There was a silence. Then the woman said,
I don't know where he's at. Who is this?
Sugar hung up the phone and went over to the counter and sat down and ordered a cup of coffee.
Has Llewellyn been in?
He said. When he pulled up in front of the garage, there were two men sitting with their backs to the wall of the building, eating their lunches. He went in. There was a man at the desk, drinking coffee and listening to the radio.
"Yes, sir,"
he said.
"I was looking for Llewellyn. He ain't here." "What time do you expect him?"
"I don't know. He ain't called in or nothing, so your guess is as good as mine."
He leaned his head slightly, as if he'd get another look at Sugar.
"Is there something I can help you with?"
"I don't think so."
Outside he stood on the broken oil-stained pavement. He looked at the two men sitting at the end of the building.
"Do you know where Llewellyn is?"
They shook their heads. Sugar got into the Ram Charger and pulled out and went back toward town. The bus pulled into Del Rio in the early afternoon, and Moss got his bags and climbed down. He walked down to the cab stand and opened the rear door of the cab parked there and got in.
"Take me to a motel," he said.
The driver looked at him in the mirror.
"You got one in mind?"
"No, just someplace cheap."
They drove out to a place called the Trail Motel, and Moss got out with his bag and the document case and paid the driver and went into the office. A woman was sitting watching television. She got up and went around behind the desk.
"Do you have a room?"
"I got more than one. How many nights?"
"I don't know.
We got a weekly rate is the reason I ask. $35 plus $1.75 tax, $36.75.
$36.75.
"Yes, sir."
"For the week?"
"Yes, sir, for the week."
"Is that your best rate?"
"Yes, sir. There's not no discounts on the weekly rate."
"Well, let's just take it one day at a time."
"Yes, sir."
He got the key and walked down to the room and went in and shut the door and set the bags on the bed. He closed the curtains and stood looking out through them at the squalid little court, dead quiet. He fastened the chain on the door and sat on the bed. He unzipped the duffel bag and took out the machine pistol and laid it on the bedspread and lay down beside it. When he woke, it was late afternoon. He lay there, looking at the stained asbestos ceiling. He sat up and pulled off his boots and socks and examined the bandages on his heels. He went into the bathroom and looked at himself in the mirror, and he took off his shirt and examined the back of his arm. It was discolored from shoulder to elbow. He walked back into the room and sat on the bed again. He looked at the gun lying there. After a while, he climbed up onto the cheap wooden desk and, with the blade of his pocket knife, set to unscrewing the air duct grill, putting the screws in his mouth one by one. Then he pulled the grill loose and laid it on the desk and stood on his toes and looked into the duct. He cut a length from the Venetian blind cord at the window and tied the end of the cord to the case. Then he unlatched the case and counted out $1,000 and folded the money and put it in his pocket and shut the case and fastened it and fastened the straps. He got the clothes pole out of the closet, sliding the wire hangers off onto the floor, and stood on the dresser again and pushed the case down the duct as far as he could reach. It was a tight fit. He took the pole and pushed it again until he could just reach the end of the rope. He put the grill back with its rack of dust and fastened the screws and climbed down and went into the bathroom and took a shower. When he came out, he lay on the bed in his shorts and pulled the chenille spread over himself and over the submachine gun at his side. He pushed the safety off. Then he went to sleep. When he woke, it was dark. He swung his legs over the edge of the bed and sat listening. He rose and walked to the window and pulled the curtain back slightly and looked out. Deep shadows, silence, nothing. He got dressed and put the gun under the mattress with the safety still off and smoothed down the dust skirt and sat on the bed and picked up the phone and called a cab. He had to pay the driver an extra $10 to take him across the bridge to Ciudad Acuña. He walked the streets, looking into the shop windows. The evening was soft and warm, and in the little Alameda, grackles were settling in the trees and calling to one another. He went into a boot shop and looked at the exotics, crocodile and ostrich and elephant, but the quality of the boots was nothing like the Larry Mahan's that he wore. He went into a pharmacia and bought a tin of bandages and sat in the park and patched his raw feet. His socks were already bloody. At the corner, a cab driver asked him if he wanted to go see the girls, and Moss held up his hand for him to see the ring he wore and kept on walking. He ate in a restaurant with white tablecloths and waiters in white jackets. He ordered a glass of red wine and a porterhouse steak. It was early and the restaurant was empty, save for him. He sipped the wine, and when the steak came, he cut into it and chewed slowly and thought about his life. He got back to the motel a little after 10 and sat in the cab with the motor running while he counted out money for the fare. He handed the bills across the seat, and he started to get out, but he didn't. He sat there with his hand on the door handle. "Drive me around to the other side," he said. The driver put the shifter in gear. "What room?" he said. "Just drive me around. I want to see if somebody's here." They drove slowly past his room. There was a gap in the curtains. He was pretty sure he hadn't left there. Hard to tell. Not that hard. The cab tolled slowly past. No cars in the lot that hadn't been there. "Keep going," he said. The driver looked at him in the mirror. "Keep going," said Moss. "Don't stop." "I don't want to get in some kind of a jackpot here, buddy. Just keep going." "Why don't I let you out here, and we won't argue about it? I want you to take me to another motel. Let's just call it square." Moss leaned forward and held a $100 bill across the seat. "You're already in a jackpot," he said. "I'm trying to get you out of it. Now take me to a motel." The driver took the bill and tucked it into his shirt pocket and turned out of the lot and into the street. He spent the night at the Ramada Inn out on the highway, and in the morning he went down and ate breakfast in the dining room and read the paper. Then he just sat there. They wouldn't be in the room when the maids came to clean it. Checkout time is 11 o'clock. They could have found the money and left. Except, of course, that there were probably at least two parties looking for him, and whichever one this was, it wasn't the other, and the other wasn't going away either. By the time he got up, he knew that he was probably going to have to kill somebody. He just didn't know who it was. He took a cab and went into town and went into a sporting goods store and bought a 12-gauge Winchester pump gun and a box of double-aught buckshot shells. The box of shells contained almost exactly the firepower of a Claymore mine. He had them wrap the gun, and he left with it under his arm and walked up Pecan Street to a hardware store. There he bought a hacksaw and a flat mill file and some miscellaneous items, a pair of pliers and a pair of side cutters, a screwdriver, flashlight, a roll of duct tape. He stood on the sidewalk with his purchases. Then he turned and walked back down the street. In the sporting goods store again, he asked the same clerk if he had any aluminum tent poles. He tried to explain that he didn't care what kind of tent it was. He just needed the poles. The clerk studied him.
"Whatever kind of tent it is," he said, "we'd still have to special order poles for it. You need to get the manufacturer and the model number."
"You sell tents, right?"
"We got three different models.
Which one has got the most poles in it?"
"Well, I guess that would be our 10-foot wall tent. You can stand up in it."
"Well, some people could stand up in it. It's got a 6-foot clearance at the ridge."
"Let me have one."
"Yes, sir."
He brought the tent from the stockroom and laid it on the counter. It came in an orange nylon bag. Moss laid the shotgun and the bag of hardware on the counter and untied the strings and pulled the tent from the bag together with the poles and cords.
"It's all there," the clerk said.
"What do I owe you?"
"It's $179 plus tax."
He laid two of the $100 bills on the counter. The tent poles were in a separate bag, and he pulled this out and put it with his other things. The clerk gave him his change and the receipt, and Moss gathered up the shotgun and his hardware purchases together with the tent poles and thanked him and turned and left.
"What about the tent?" the clerk called.
In the room, he unwrapped the shotgun and wedged it in an open drawer and held it and sawed the barrel off just in front of the magazine. He squared up the cut with the file and smoothed it and wiped out the muzzle of the barrel with a damp face cloth and set it aside. Then he sawed off the stock in a line that left it with a pistol grip and sat on the bed and dressed the grip smooth with the file. When he had it the way he wanted it, he slid the forearm back and slid it forward again and let the hammer down with his thumb and turned it sideways and looked at it.
It looked pretty good.
He turned it over and opened the box of shells and fed the heavy waxed loads into the magazine one by one. He jacked the slide back and chambered a shell and lowered the hammer and then put one more round in the magazine and laid the gun across his lap. It was less than 2 feet long. He called the Trail Motel and told the woman to hold his room for him. Then he shoved the gun and the shells and the tools under the mattress and went out again. He went to Walmart and bought some clothes and a small nylon zipper bag to put them in, a pair of jeans and a couple of shirts and some socks. In the afternoon, he went for a long walk out along the lake, taking the cut-off gun barrel and the stock with him in the bag. He slung the barrel out into the water as far as he could throw it, and he buried the stock under a ledge of shale. There were deer moving away through the desert scrub. He heard them snort, and he could see them where they came out on the ridge 100 yards away to stand looking back at him. He sat on a gravel beach with the empty bag folded in his lap and watched the sunset, watched the land turn blue and cold. An osprey went down the lake. Then there was just the darkness.